Next case on the docket is Cormark versus Sonatrol. I see the council are ready. Let's proceed.
May it please the court, Kirk Ingebretson on behalf of Sonatrol number 11444, and with me at council's table is Richard Sander. In a prior appeal in this case, which I refer to as Sonatrol 1, a different panel of this court created a new hybrid tort claim, willful and wanton breach of a commercial contract, where only economic damages were sought. In doing so, it interjected tort elements of fault and culpability, contrary to the bedrock legal principle that parties to commercial contracts of equal bargaining power have every right to breach a commercial contract intentionally or consciously, as long as they pay the damages that the parties agreed in the contract they would pay, or alternatively were reasonably foreseeable at the time of contracting. This was contrary as well and ignored the fact that Cormark and Sonatrol agreed in the contract that Sonatrol would not be an insurance company, which it ended up being, that Cormark would obtain its own insurance, which it did, and that if Cormark wanted, it could pay more and increase the limit of liability in the contract. It elected not to do that. The panel in Sonatrol 1 relied exclusively on tort cases where the only duty breached was a common law tort duty, not one like the one here, which arose solely from contract. It relied on those cases to hold that the limitation of liability was against public policy to cover willful and wanton conduct. The prior panel also incorporated the definition of willful and wanton from the exemplary damages statute, rather than the more applicable one, if they're going down that route, in the statute pertaining to willful and wanton breach and seeking non-economic damages.
Could you just refresh my memory briefly? What are the two different standards? What do they say?
Between economic and
non-economic? Well, between willful and wanton standard here and the second willful and wanton standard that you said should have been
the willful and wanton standard that was probably more applicable simply says a conscious breach without reasonable justification. The definition that the prior panel adopted for Sonatrol was an intentional breach with a conscious disregard for the safety or rights of others, particularly the plaintiff. So it involved more elements of culpability.
So let me just interrupt you here and just say I'm gathering that there are many things you don't like about this prior decision. Did you make these arguments to the Supreme Court?
The Supreme Court, the issue in the before the Supreme Court was primarily, and according to Cormark in the brief, exclusively whether or not a limitation of liability, which is in this contract, or could be characterized as liquidated damages, if that difference made a difference to regard the policy. It's my understanding that the specific argument being made today was not made before the Supreme Court. It was really the question of whether or not a liquidated damages provision should be treated differently than a limitation of liability. We believe that Sonatrol 1 was incorrectly decided, and this panel has the right to revisit that and reach a contrary decision. But if you decide to follow Sonatrol 1, it's undisputed that the prior panel did not address whether, upon remand, in light of this new hybrid tort claim, Sonatrol should be able to allocate fault to the non-party, the arsonist who torched the building. On remand, the trial court incorrectly held that Sonatrol did not have that right to allocate fault under 13-21-111.5 for two reasons. First, she held that the arsonist did not owe a duty to Cormark, which is clearly wrong, because everyone owes a common law tort duty not to cause intentional damage to someone else's person or property. The second basis was that because the commercial contract at issue was a contract, that the statute of allocation of non-parties of fault did not apply to that, ignoring the fact that the statute uses the word fault, which this court and the Supreme Court have held to encompass a broad range of culpable behavior.
Counsel, on that point, I don't recall any case in which the court, though, has said it applies to breach of contract, only to intentional torts.
Well, this is an issue of first impression in light of the fact that Sinatra 1 created this new hybrid tort. However, there is an analogous case, which we analyzed in our brief, Judge Jones, dealing with an intentional bad faith breach of an insurance contract, which is applicable and analogous because, like the Sinatra contract, the duty breach there is contract-based. There's no common law duty to provide insurance. There's no common law duty to provide alarm monitoring services. It's contract-based. But courts in this jurisdiction have held when there's a bad faith breach of that contract in that limited context, a bad faith breach involving issues of fault and culpability, then it's considered a tort. And the Supreme Court and this court, in that context, has held in a bad faith breach of an insurance contract, apportionment under the statute is permitted.
That gets to the issue then of whether we're talking about a tort claim or a contract claim. And I understand your position is that the prior division created a tort claim. But there are cases that say there is a contract claim for a willful and wanton breach of contract. There are cases like that in Colorado.
For non-economic damages,
but it's still recognized as a contract claim and not a tort claim.
And
I guess I'm looking at the prior division. I'm saying, well, what about this is creating a tort claim? They're just saying that if your breach is willful and wanton, then the limitation of liability doesn't apply. They're not saying it's a tort claim.
They probably didn't use that characterization, but it has all the elements of a tort claim. In fact, if you read the concurring opinion of Justice Bender in the GM Papa case, which addressed that very issue, he commented on the fact that this was a huge erosion of the economic loss rule in his concurring opinion. Nonetheless, for over 90 years, Colorado has recognized that no exception for non-economic losses. Willful and wanton is relevant in that very limited context. But the Sinatra 1 panel blew that out and has applied it now to commercial contracts where only economic damages are sought. And I think I know where you're going, Judge Jones, and I think there is law that for the garden variety contract, the allocation statute does not apply. But this is not a garden variety breach of contract claim. It includes elements of fault and culpability that really have no place, in our view, in commercial contracts with parties of equal bargaining power. But if the court is going to follow Sinatra 1, we believe that the court erred in not allowing allocation of fault down below. And this had the unintended consequence of putting Sinatra in a very awkward position of being stripped of the benefit of the limitation of liability the parties bargained for to keep the price of the service down, and also precluded by allocating fault to the arsonist who torched the building. We believe that in light of the Harvey and Slack case, where this court and the Supreme Court has recognized, and in the analogous claim of bad faith breach of insurance contract with a source of the duty is contract, allocation is permitted, that the same should be done here. It's even more compelling here, because unlike an insurance company who owes the insured a quasi-fiduciary duty, no such quasi-fiduciary duty or special relationship exists between Sinatra and the alarm company and the other party of the contract, Core-Mark. The second basis why we believe a new trial is required is the trial court erred in excluding expert testimony offered by Sinatra to rebut expert and lay testimony offered by Core-Mark. In particular, Core-Mark was allowed to present both lay and expert testimony that there were no storage rules relating to the storage of hazardous materials, that their sprinkler system complied with the code, and that they complied with the building and fire codes with regard to the storage of these hazardous materials. Sinatra offered expert testimony to say that wasn't true. Their sprinkler system was not code compliant. They stored, in one case, 31 times the legal limit of the most flammable liquids than allowed by the fire code. Nonetheless, the trial court excluded that testimony after allowing Core-Mark to testify on those issues. Core-Mark is now claiming that is harmless error, that it wasn't relevant. But at the time, after offering lay and expert testimony, they then argued in closing argument, reminding the jury about that testimony and pointing out that it was significant that Sonatrol didn't offer any expert testimony to support its side of the case.
And so would you explain to me how it was relevant on the issue, particularly on the issue of foreseeability?
Yes, Your Honor. If I may, before I, as a threshold matter, say that because of opening the door, I believe that even inadmissible evidence becomes admissible once the door is open. But nonetheless, it's independently relevant to the issue of foreseeability, because the test in Colorado is not just that the type of damage must be foreseeable, but the extent of the damage as well, which is not to say you need to be able to foresee it with precision or great detail. But foreseeability is an issue of fact for the jury to decide. And it is certainly arguable, and the jury could find, that Sonatrol had no way of knowing, and in fact did not know, of the extreme violations of the fire code in the sprinkler system, the storage of hazardous materials, that contributed to the spread of the fire. And therefore, when the parties made the contract, that it was not reasonably foreseeable as a probable result, not possible, the standard is probable result of the breach, that the entire 120,000 square foot warehouse would be burned to the ground. And recall that the testimony was that the fire department arrived 11 minutes after the fire was set, and this 120,000 square foot warehouse was already up in flames. So whether or not you think it was foreseeable, it was an issue for the jury to decide, especially when they only got half the story. The other thing to keep in mind from just a fundamental fairness point of view is that, especially in this new context of willful and wanton and culpable allegations and culpable behavior, the jury doesn't assess damages in a vacuum. They got the half the story. The jury was led to believe, misled to believe, that Core-Mark did everything right and Sonatrol did everything wrong. In the GM Papa case, the Colorado Supreme Court pointed out in the context of a willful and wanton claim for non-economic damages that because of the allegations of willful and wanton, the plaintiff's burden of proving damages can be lower. Well, especially in that kind of context, it was unfair not to let Sonatrol respond to the contrary evidence of code compliance and that their fire suppression system met code. This simply was unfair. Unless you have other questions, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time. Thank you.
May it please the court, I'm Andrew Lowe, counsel for the appellees, which I will refer to collectively as Core-Mark. I think we need to go right to the point that opposing counsel made in his argument about Sonatrol 1. He starts right off by claiming that Sonatrol 1 created a new hybrid tort action. I submit that that is entirely untrue. In fact, Sonatrol 1 was about an affirmative defense, not about the nature of the cause of action. The actual cause of action brought by Core-Mark was for breach of contract. Simple, straightforward breach of contract. Contract provided that Sonatrol would use would make reasonable efforts to apprehend break-ins, and we contended that they didn't, and in so doing, that they breached the contract. Indeed, there would have been no duty of care here but for the contract. Thus, the cause of action is breach of contract. The only issue in Sonatrol 1 was whether Sonatrol could raise an affirmative defense to damages if its conduct was later deemed to be, found by the jury, to be willful and wanton. So this whole business about creation of a new cause of action, I don't know where this comes from. It does not, you know, for example, I presented a hypothetical in my brief of a seller of coal. And I pointed out that if the seller of coal decided it was economically rational to breach the contract and pay damages, nothing in Sonatrol 1 affects that decision or imposes any additional liability. For example, there's no, if this were a tort claim, you know, there would be unliquidated damages possible for non-economic loss, pain and suffering, mental distress, all those kinds of things. Nothing like this. This is a pure economic case for breach of contract. And I should point out, although it was toward the end of my opposing counsel's argument, he started talking about the jury's assessment of the amount of damages. The amount of damages was not in controversy at trial. Sonatrol did not contest the amount if they were found liable.
Basically, the value of the goods.
And the value of the goods plus business interruption, that's right. Yes. So I think it's most important, therefore, that we debunk right at the beginning this notion that Sonatrol 1 somehow created a new cause of action. It did not. What Sonatrol really is doing is they are asking you to let them enforce a limitation of liability clause in their contract, which would limit to a nominal sum the damages that Sonatrol would have to pay, even though their conduct has been found to be willful and wanton by a jury and not challenged on appeal. If this court were to accept that invitation, it would become the first court in the nation to hold that a burglar alarm company can be found guilty of willful and wanton conduct and yet still effectively limit all its liability and pay nothing more than the nominal amount specified in the contract.
Mr. Lowe, do I understand your argument, I'm looking at page 20 of your brief, to be that Sonatrol 1 is leaving intact the possibility to engage in a willful or even an intentional breach, but not one that's willful and wanton?
Well, yes, this is an excellent question, Your Honor. Let me address this exactly. Throughout this whole case, there has been some confusion about, well, are we getting into the state of mind of the contracting party and deciding whether to breach or not? No. Sonatrol 1 pertains to a class of contracts providing for the provision of services in the future. Now, if Sonatrol had decided deliberately to breach by sending a letter to Cormark saying, we don't want to perform anymore, even though there was no right to breach and no right to terminate, that would have been a deliberate breach. No additional liability. That's not willful and wanton. There's nothing wrong with that. They can do that and they can pay damages under the usual contract formula. But here, where it provides, the contract provides for future services, what we're talking about is not the decision to breach or perform. We are talking about the manner in which the services are performed. Often, services like this can be a matter of grave economic concern or even, in fact, life or death. One of Sonatrol's own operators admitted during the trial that lives were at stake with respect to Sonatrol's performance of their services. And so the issue is not, should I breach or not? The issue is, how were the services performed? And if they, after agreeing to perform the services, they performed in such a shockingly deficient manner that it exposed the other side to economic loss and even potential physical or personal injury, that's willful and wanton, as the jury found. In that very, very limited circumstance, we will say, the law says, that you cannot now take advantage of your limitation of liability clause. Well, where does that come from? Sonatrol says that that comes from tort law. It does not. It is a simple and overarching public policy, as Sonatrol 1 correctly refers to. If you go back to Sonatrol 1, it specifically refers to this being a matter of public policy. The public policy is you don't get to agree to provide services and then say, but I'm reserving an out, and I'm reserving the right to engage in serious misconduct in the future in providing those services, but it doesn't matter because my liability is always limited to $500. Public policy says they can't do that. Now, they can miss a break-in. They can try real hard. The operator is listening very hard, and for whatever reason, doesn't hear the break-in. There's no breach in that circumstance because Sonatrol has tried, has exercised care, but didn't detect. So, no breach. Sonatrol can even be negligent. They can be careless. They can have made a mistake that a reasonable person would not have made. And in that case, they did breach, but their liability is limited to $500. All Sonatrol has to do to avoid losing the protection of the limitation of liability clause is to refrain from willful and wanton misconduct. a very, very low threshold indeed. And for that reason, for that same reason, I'd like to now sort of segue to my opponent's argument that this would turn Sonatrol into an insurer. I suggest not so. An insurer is liable without fault. If covered damage occurs, damage within the terms of the policy, the insurer must pay. That's simple. Not so with Sonatrol. Sonatrol is not liable if they comply with the contract, not liable if they breach negligently, still $500. Only if they engage in the most extreme form of misconduct would they be liable for the full foreseeable damages.
Is it correct, as your opposing counsel states in his reply brief, that an insurer can allocate fault if it's found liable for bad faith breach of contract?
Another excellent question, Your Honor. I am baffled about why our opponents keep bringing up insurance bad faith and the GM Papa case. This case and that kind of litigation has nothing to do with each other. Insurance bad faith is a tort. It has been so held. I can't give you the citation, but there's just no doubt about it whatsoever. We certainly agree that in tort litigation, a tort defendant can make use of Section 111.5 and can designate non-parties at fault in tort litigation, which includes litigation like GM Papa and all insurance bad faith litigation. And I might add that that was also about non-economic damages, you know, pain and suffering and so on, which totally inapplicable here. So we're not talking about a tort action here. This is a claim for breach of contract. So let's move on, since my opponent then, after point one, moved on to point two briefly, which is this allocation of fault point. Very quickly, allocation of fault statute, section 111.5, only applies to tort cases. Could not be clearer. If you read through the text of the statute, it is permeated with the language of tort claims. Death, injury, negligence, fault, so on and so forth. Nowhere in the statute is there a reference to contracts or agreements or anything else that would suggest that the legislators had contracts in mind. And of course, you know from our brief that we went back and pulled the legislative history when we listened to the audio tape, and we found that in the conference committee, as it happened, they talked about this very situation. And the very last amendment that they made was to change the applicability of the statute from negligence actions to actions. They took out the word negligence. And the tape reveals that they did that because one of the legislators was concerned that by putting in the word negligence, that it would limit the statute to only negligence actions and might cut off applicability to other tort actions like product liability, strict liability, and so on. And so they took out negligence to avoid that restriction. And then, incredibly, one of the other legislators piped up and asked, but it wouldn't have, I don't have the exact language, but it wouldn't apply to contract actions, right? And another legislator said, that's right. So, no question, they talked about it, it doesn't apply to contract actions. And this is entirely consistent with the differences between tort law and contract law, which are not being intermingled here at all. Tort law, of course, a tortfeasor can get contribution. A party and a defendant in a breach of contract case cannot get contribution. There's no such thing as a contribution action by a defendant for breach of contract against a person who's not a party to the contract. Opposing counsel said, well, the district court was wrong in saying that the arsonist didn't owe a duty to Cormark to avoid arson. Well, of course, he owed a tort duty not to torch the warehouse. But the key point here is not that. The key point is that we sued for breach of contract, and the arsonist was not a party to the contract. He was a stranger to the contract, and there is no legal mechanism in our system for a defendant in a contract case to slough off some of the liability on someone who's not even a party to the contract. That system does not exist. So the district court was correct in declining to allow declining to allow Sonatrol to designate the arsonist as a non-party at fault. Moving on then to the last point, which is the exclusion of the expert witnesses. I first want to point out that throughout this case, Sonatrol has accused trial counsel for Cormark of, you know, deliberately putting in this evidence and then arguing it in the closing. If you go to the closing argument, there is the lightest reference to this. It's a once over. It's mentioned in one sentence at one point where counsel was just recounting the evidence witness by witness. And then it's mentioned in one sentence much later in the argument where counsel was talking about whether our evidence amounted to a preponderance of the evidence. And that's it. This was not some major point that got a lot of attention in closing argument. In terms of opening the door, you know, you heard opposing counsel say that Cormark was allowed to put on this evidence about the fire code. There was no objection to any of that evidence. So, of course, we were allowed to put it on. If Sonatrol had wanted to, they could have objected and gone up to bench and said, Your Honor, they've got a motion pending to strike our response of experts. If you grant that, this is going to be irrelevant. So make them wait until you've ruled on that motion.
So are you conceding that the evidence was irrelevant?
Totally irrelevant.
That the evidence offered by your client was irrelevant?
I think the evidence, the entire subject was irrelevant, and we had moved to preclude their experts because it was irrelevant and also because of Schreck. And unfortunately, there was no ruling. And so they were in the middle of their case, and they had the witness there, and they didn't know whether the experts for Sonatrol were going to be able to testify. So they said, okay, you know, we're going to put our evidence on. The fire marshal got up, and he said there was no violation of the fire code. He sat down, and that was that. But it does not matter because if you think, how does this affect foreseeability of damages? The answer is it doesn't. This whole business relates to the state of the warehouse in 2002, which was when the fire was. Now, foreseeability has to be evaluated as of the date of contracting, which was 1995. So the foreseeability to a party in Sonatrol's position in 1995 of future damages cannot, by definition, be affected by events that have not happened yet and are not going to happen for another 7 years.
But doesn't the alarm company have the right to assume that whoever is using the warehouse is going to comply with the law, particularly those laws which might relate to safety and storing hazardous materials, flammable materials? I mean, that sounds like a rational thing that an alarm company might be concerned about.
But the logical implication of that assumption, let's just say they made that assumption, and it's not in the contract, of course, is because we assume that they will comply with the fire code, a large-scale fire is impossible. In other words, we can't foresee a large fire if an arsonist is undetected, breaks in, and sets a fire using an accelerant. And it's obviously foreseeable. We know they cited the Fox alarm and the Saya Foods cases for a different point, but in both of those cases, the thief broke in and then set a fire to cover his tracks. This kind of thing happens frequently. They know it. Their witnesses admitted they know it. It's clearly foreseeable that an arsonist is going to burn the place down. I see my time has expired. Thank you.
Cormark now claims that the evidence lay and expert evidence it offered about compliance with the fire and building codes was irrelevant at the trial, but their behavior and conduct at the trial belies that, since they commented on that in their closing argument and the significance of that and the significance of the absence of contrary testimony offered by Sonatrol, because the judge had excluded that contrary testimony. Also, the fact that the juror asked a question about were there any rules regarding the storage of hazardous materials shows that it was not irrelevant. The jury believed it was relevant. Counsel for Cormark thought it was relevant. It was relevant. It was relevant to foreseeability, and Sonatrol was injured, severely injured, by not being allowed to put on contrary evidence. You would not be the only court to hold that A limitation of liability clause is enforceable even when there are allegations of willful and wanton contract. The ALR article that Mr. Lowe cites in his answer brief as the overwhelming national trend, almost all of them involved only tort claims, not contract-based claim. The only exception was the Summers case in New York. And the New York court held there that even though it was just a contract-based claim like we have here, that there was a public policy against allowing that to be enforced because in that case, the alarm company had a franchise from the city of New York and it was regulated by the city of New York. And they found that to be determinative in finding a public policy. All the other cases are tort cases. Finally, it's undeniable that in the limited situation where a bad faith breach of contract causes an indivisible injury to the victim with another person at fault, that the Colorado Supreme Court has allowed allocation of fault under the statute. The usual situation is when there's a denial in benefits, and that's not going to cause an indivisible injury. It's a different kind of damage. But in that unique case where the allegation for the bad faith breach of contract was a grossly negligent referral to someone who committed sexual assault, and the tortfeasor who committed the assault, different duties, different sources, they allowed them to allocate. And we should too. Thank you.
The counsel for your arguments will issue an opinion in the case in due course.